Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, March 17th, 2025. It's St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
You should be out there wearing the green and speaking in funny accents.
I don't do these stereotypical clichés.
You know, one of the things it's a funny association I have with St. Patrick's Day now, because, of course, 5 years ago, at the beginning of the pandemic, was St. Patrick's Day was one of the days it became really obvious that something very serious was happening, because up to that point, you know, the pandemic had been declared by the World Health Organization, and as we moved into the beginning of March, things seemed to be happening more and more. But people were still getting a sense of it, and I remember that the government here decided that they were so worried about what would happen on St. Patrick's Day that people would be crowding into bars, that they closed all the bars on that day 5 years ago to make sure people stayed at home. And that was one of the days like, wow, this is actually really serious that they're going this far, and everything accelerated. You know, within the week, everyone was offices everywhere. Not even the week. I think before the end of the week, it was like a Tuesday or something like that. And before the end of the week, everybody closed down pretty much everything. Offices were closed. People were working from home. Anything that wasn't an essential service was being shut down. And we were all home on our own for the next 6 weeks to 2 months.
Well, what's sort of intriguing is this. This is not what they call a statutory holiday. Nobody gets a day off.
Yep.
And it's funny that, you know, from a cultural aspect, why is this something that's sort of multicultural? It sort of goes over everything. It's become stereotypical American-Canadian culture for this.
That's a good question. I mean, I suppose it has something to do with, you know, a big influx of Irish immigrants in the 19th century, you know, and I guess, you know, the other fact I'd say is, you know, its association with partying and liquor has made it a favorite of bars and nightclubs as a way to draw in crowds and get a full house on that day.
Well, the bars probably propagated it.
I'm sure to a large extent.
Well, there's also the St. Patrick's Day Parade. Is that in New York City or something?
There's probably more than one, but yeah.
Yeah, so it's one of these things. The other thing is that for the this is sort of a past cultural thing, but they used to do in the cartoons about the leprechaun. This was over 50 years ago. The Jackson 5 had their own, on Saturday mornings, had their own cartoon show. And the Osmonds also had their own cartoon show when they were all small. Like, they had Jimmy, and they had one episode where they meet a leprechaun. So it's just this if you talk about Ireland, it used to be Huckleberry Howe to meet the magical leprechaun.
I'd be curious to know if those cartoons are available anywhere. I'm sure they are. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
I don't know. It's one of these things.
Yeah. All right. Well, for the show today, that's it for our St. Patrick's Day content
let's
today.
Just bury and get it.
We do have a report from Danny Nesvadarani about Vancouver farmers and their organizing, because they're worried about the tariffs and how they're going to handle everything that's going on these days with our trade relationship with the United States. We also have a report from our friends at CFUR in Prince George about glaciers and the retreat of glaciers and the fact that by the end of this century, we may have almost no glaciers left in British Columbia. Something that's, you look at photographs of our mountains from even 50 years ago, and you can see the dramatic retreat of many well-known glaciers. We have another report from Smithers about how the now tenuous and difficult relationship with the United States is affecting things there, and some controversy around the flying of an American flag on Main Street. Peter, you have
I did it on Friday afternoon, and she's now a counselor at Port Moody, but she was one of the 50 people working at aluminum smelter in Kitimat. She was the only woman there for two summers.
Yeah.
And she graduated also from SFU here.
Yeah.
And so, but I did an 11-minute interview about, she was born in Kitimat, and a bit about working there and growing up in Kitimat. So
great. Aluminum very much in the news today, also with tariffs and Donald Trump and the relationship between U.S. and Canada. We also have our first edition of the year of Gardening with Embark, our weekly gardening segment to help you grow your garden better. And that'll be coming up in at about probably around 9:35. And your report will come up around 9:50?
Yes.
Or 10:50, rather?
Well, I need to. It's at 11 minutes, Magnus. Give me a break here.
Yeah. all right. Well, let's get the show under on the go. And this is our report from Danny Nisvadarani.
We hosted surveys. We have over hundreds of farmers responding to these surveys.
Oh.
I am struggling. This is why I'm struggling. This is the way I need help. Because, folks, if we want good solutions, we need concrete data. That's the way it works in the business world. That's the approach we're applying here today. But we, including me and Vikram, have spent years on the phone, it feels like, just talking to people, talking to farmers, what is going on. And not just farmers, industry experts, retailers, everybody. What are the challenges that you're experiencing?
Reporting from Port Coquitlam, BC, this is Danny Nisvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. On March 9th, during a rain-filled, chilly Sunday night, over 150 farmers and farming supporters from all across the Lower Mainland met in Port Coquitlam, BC, for a community town hall to discuss the main issues that local farmers are facing in the province. Gagan Singh, the presenting organizer of the town hall who you just heard, is a farming advocate and a farmer himself in Abbotsford, BC. This is the third town hall that he has hosted now, where he got together with farmers to not only discuss the issues currently plaguing farmers in BC, but some of the potential solutions as well. After the town hall, CJSF got in contact with Singh, where we learned about how he was able to mobilize farmers from all across the Lower Mainland, as well as what he hopes these town halls are able to accomplish for farming in BC.
So my background is marketing, right? I worked with Microsoft, Coca-Cola, all the big guys, helped them make tons and tons of money. And recently, I inherited my dad's farm. And I started getting into farming. Like, you know what? Farming sounds nice. It's a simple lifestyle. We have 8 acres. I can make it, because I don't need a lot of money to be happy. I can just do like a simple farm, make some money. But man, as soon as I got into the farming industry, I just realized how difficult it is, how challenging it is. And it made me realize, man, the public does not realize what is going on, why farming is so difficult. And that's a big disconnect. And I started making TikTok videos in the summer. I just gave away all our blueberries because I couldn't sell them. So I kind of used it to launch my campaign, and that really popped off. But a big part of what I'm doing is I'm using my marketing skills to educate the public, to bring people together, and I'm using my business entrepreneur skills to create solutions. So it's very well needed because farmers don't know how to market, and they definitely don't know how to get their voice out there. So again, I'm not the expert. I'm just kind of bringing everybody together. They're sharing information to me and I'm projecting it out there.
Singh also discussed what he believes is one of the most important reasons for holding these town halls.
Yeah. So that town hall was very strategic. Okay. It's not just to collect feedback. It's to get people away from their phones and meeting in person. Right. We're trying to build a solid community of people that we can rely on. And that can only happen to face-to-face interactions. So to answer your question, one of the biggest reasons we're doing those town halls is to instill hope in people. After the pandemic, people have lost hope and they've lost faith in their institutions. Right. And what I'm seeing is there's a huge lack of hope. But now you can see that spark in people. They see something that they can believe in. They're like, you know what? Especially because I can be very transparent. I can trust this person. If they can trust me, then they can trust the people we're working with. Then they can trust farmers. So I think the biggest thing is the challenge has been everyone has lost hope in everything around them. And the beautiful thing about these town halls is we've created a spark of hope in people, which is extremely powerful. And we can now take that and turn it into something.
And while that something hasn't been fully developed yet, Singh hopes that it results in a sort of knowledge network for farmers all around BC to share their expertise and build each other up. According to Singh, a website for this movement should be up within the next couple of months. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that. Next up, glaciers and are one of the sort of canaries in the coal mine of climate change. Glaciers have been in retreat around the world, and of course here in BC, which has is the home to many glaciers, including many well-known ones in some of our national and provincial parks, have been on retreat also. Ian Gregg from CFUR in Prince George talks to glaciologist Dr. Brian Manunus of UNBC's geography program about what's happening with the glaciers in BC.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca. Or CFUR.ca.
When we think about the end of this century, by and large, most of the ice in the Fraser Basin will be gone.
That's according to a new study by Dr. Brian Manunus, glaciologist based at the University of Northern British Columbia, in the Department of Geography, Earth, and Environmental Sciences, or GEES, or GEES,
and also working right now for the federal government, Natural Resources Canada, Geological Survey of Canada.
He has recently participated in a study providing a comprehensive assessment of worldwide glacier mass loss between the year 2000 and 2023.
Well, this particular study, I'm one of many, many authors, and it really is the summary of a workshop and a intercomparison exercise by glaciologists worldwide to better understand how much and where and how quickly glaciers are disappearing and melting from Earth's mountains. There have been a number of studies, recent and a benchmark one in 2015, which really looked at the projected loss of glaciers. So in those earlier papers clearly show, unfortunately, that glaciers are not long for our world, especially those small ones. When we think about the end of this century, by and large, most of the ice in the Fraser Basin will be gone. In Western Canada, for example, over the 23-year period, we've lost about 23%, so about 1% per year. That has not been uniform. There are some years where we lose much more. But we're really starting with a smaller amount of ice. And these are really small glaciers, relatively small, compared to some of the large truly large ice fields in the northern coast mountains, the St. Elias, even under very high emission scenarios, those areas will continue to have perhaps one half of the remaining ice. If we were, for example, to compare to the ice in Arctic Canada. But collectively, Canada is home to nearly one quarter of Earth's ice.
That's significant.
Unfortunately for us, however, because the glaciers are small in the Fraser Basin, they're not really expected to be around by the end of this century. And that has implications, not just for buffering capacity as seasonal snow has been depleted, but rather it's also a part of our legacy and part of our cultural, if you will, identity. You know, when I first moved to British Columbia, I fell in love with the mountains simply because they were ice-clad and beautiful, beautiful glaciers.
And there's a reasonable chance that it just might not be like that anymore in the relatively near future, if we're looking at a timescale of thousands of years. Certainly, this is a lot closer than far away.
This is by the end of this century, so that's not thousands, that's 80 years, less than 80, which is quite worrisome, to say the least.
Overall, there is a net loss.
Sadly, there's a net loss. And for this particular study, if we took all of the ice, converted it to water, then over that 23-year period, it's accounted for about 1.8 centimeters of sea level rise. And to think of it in another way,
okay. So
it corresponds to 276, I think, I can't remember, 70-something gigatons of mass change per year. And that's kind of a hard number to visualize, but one gigaton is 1 billion cubic meters. So imagine a billion full-size pickup trucks with their backs filled with water. That's about a cubic meter. So each year we're losing 273 billion of those per year.
It's incredible. Throughout the media we've consumed in pop culture over our lives, people may generally think of this affecting coastal areas and maybe a future where we all become pseudo-pirates like in James Cameron's Waterworld or something like that. But are there implications more locally in our own region of central interior BC that you could perhaps illustrate?
Mm-hmm. So in addition to sea level rise, so this particular study and others before it have really shown first with respect to sea level that melting glaciers right now represent the second largest component responsible for sea level rise. So this is larger right now than the Greenland melt from the Greenland ice sheet. It's substantially larger than the Antarctic ice sheet, but it's not as large as the sea level rise component due to thermal expansion of water. So as you heat up water and the Earth has gotten warmer, you allow that water to accommodate more volume, and as a result, that's causing sea levels to rise. But back to BC, why do glaciers matter? These are important natural resources that in many times are supplementing our headwater streams when seasonal snow is at a minimum or is melted away. Also during times of drought, these glaciers kick in and allow cool, plentiful water to exist in many of these streams. And it's really important for aquatic ecosystems. In some cases, in some of the watersheds that drain into Alberta, they do represent important freshwater flow for human consumption and agriculture. And also in some cases, for some of our watersheds, the melt from glaciers is responsible or helps to supplement clean energy, so hydropower generation.
So we're looking at locally in our region, certainly something like salmon stocks could be affected, steelhead, the river ecology could certainly be affected by this, mm-hmm. And electricity, something we all depend on, is another big factor in our day-to-day lives that could dramatically affect it.
That's right. And there's also another component, and that is the changes in geohazards. So as we get our mountains becoming deglacierized, we are actually exposing steeply sloped terrain, which is sometimes unfortunately susceptible to landslides. And so This can occur largely through a concept referred to as debuttressing. Mm-hmm. So as we have a glaciated valley that becomes ice-free, you're setting up steep terrain, which is susceptible to failure. And those landslides can sometimes enter a standing body of water, and that can cause what's called an outburst flood. In some cases, we may also get small surficial lakes forming on top of glaciers adjacent to the margins, and these can sometimes drain underneath the ice. And we had a particular event happen in Pemberton, outside of Pemberton last July. And that was an event that fortunately did not kill anyone, but was responsible for mobilizing sediment in a channel, causing a type of landslide called a debris flow, and also impacted downstream agricultural land, but also some footbridges as well.
If we're looking at our lives here in central interior, northern BC, a time period of within this century that we might not be seeing glaciers in our landscape, what kind of changes are you thinking we may experience within our world that as we know it here in Prince George? Do you think our way of life may change to the extent that we might all be having different jobs? We might all be doing completely different things because we have to adapt to a very different world.
Lots of questions there and lots of implications. There's no question that climate change and rising temperatures induced and primarily driven by rising greenhouse gas emissions have altered the climate that we're seeing, and they will continue to alter the climate going forward. This has implications not just for glaciers and sea level rise. You know, don't forget, the contribution from glaciers continues to decrease. We'll start to get a larger component from the ice sheets such as Greenland. And that's a bit worrisome because there is a substantial sea level rise potential of the Greenland ice sheet. It's not going to melt next year, and it's not going to melt entirely within 100 years. But the contribution as we get towards the end of the century will be larger and larger. So the consequences of sea level rise will create conditions where it will cost more people to mitigate and protect against coastal erosion, against rising waters due to flooding. And so that has implications for everyone's insurance. Think, for example, of what just happened in California. Those fires, the fires that we've had in Jasper, the fires that we continue to have year after year in British Columbia, these are increasing costs of insurance. And so climate change is having a profound effect on everyone's way of life, whether you're a forester, whether you're a glaciologist, whether you're just simply listening to this program in Prince George. It will affect everyone, and it continues to affect everyone.
The nice thing about this research is that it's not necessarily behind a paywall. Where can people access your research and your findings? How can we read about
it? A number of ways. I always encourage interested public to reach out and contact me. You can certainly contact me at the university. If you're a sharp, aspiring, interested student, come work with us. Come talk to us. You can certainly download a copy of the Glambi paper, but you can also certainly contact me or contact anyone in GEES for information about snow and ice.
Can't do this work alone.
Always looking for sharp, talented students.
Thanks so much for your time with us in studio today, Brian. I really appreciate it.
No, it's a lot of fun.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you wish I had asked?
My favorite karaoke song?
Yeah, definitely.
Copacabana.
Nice. That's a good one. That's a good one.
That's about it.
Right on. I'm working on my Chris Stapleton voice. It's not going very well. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
This is Bird Note. When a field sparrow builds a nest in early spring, dense grasses offer the best cover, so that's where she builds. but it's only the first of several nests she'll make. Later in the season, as shrubs and trees grow their leaves, field sparrows nest again and again, higher off the ground each time, to protect their eggs from mammals and snakes. This multiple nest strategy helps field sparrows make use of all the warm months of the year for their breeding season. Field sparrows build their cup-shaped nest in fields and in brushy areas, but they avoid human activity and they're sensitive to suburban sprawl. Conserving brushy habitats and agricultural landscapes will help field sparrows keep building their nest higher and higher every summer. Outside of town, listen for the field sparrow's song, which sounds like a ping pong ball bouncing and then coming to rest. And watch their trick to eat grass seeds, jumping on the end of a grass stalk, riding it to the ground, then chowing down on the seeds. Good eating. For Bird Note, I'm Joni Franklin. This episode is sponsored by Wendy Legg in honor of her husband, Gordon Legg, who loves listening to and recording all bird songs.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
The strained relationship between the U.S. and Canada in the wake of Donald Trump's attacks on our sovereignty and the levying of tariffs is really straining the relationship, not only between the countries, but between our citizens as well. Up in Smithers, B.C., the flying of a United States flag on Main Street is causing controversy. This report is from our friends at CICK Radio in Smithers.
This is CICK News. For over four decades, the town of Smithers has flown flags from countries around the world along Main Street. One of those flags hangs outside of Skeena MP Taylor Bacharach's office, and it happens to be the American flag. Listen to his thoughts on that today on CICK News, as well as perspectives from people walking by his office on a sunny Tuesday afternoon.
It's Taylor Bacharach. I'm the Member of Parliament for Skeena-Buckley Valley.
So I'm sure you're getting interviewed about this a lot, but something that's within your line of vision is there's an American flag outside of your office in downtown Smithers on Main Street.
Yeah.
And I've heard you want that taken down. Is this true?
Yeah, I'm not crazy about the flag that's outside of the office. I think if anything, we should have the Canadian flag flying outside the office of the federal elected representatives. Mm-hmm. I've conveyed that to the mayor.
Ever since the 1980s, the town of Smithers has hung flags from countries on poles along Main Street. Requests can be made to include countries as there are less poles than countries on the globe, and the town does its best to accommodate those requests. And so I asked Smithers Mayor Gladys Attrill what she thought.
Well, I feel fine about it. I think personally, you know, there's so much going on right now that I think is important for us to remember what the issues are. And I am, like many Canadians, pretty upset with the decisions made by the American administration. I, like many, am becoming more and more fiercely patriotic about this country that I love. At the same time, I think one of the values of being Canadian is that we're welcoming people, and I'm not mad at American citizens. And this community has had long relationships with people who are American, so I do hope we're still a welcoming community.
And aside from one letter, this has not come to council yet?
No. Yeah, no, it hasn't.
Yeah, I just think given the times that we're in, I'd love to see the Canadian flag flying outside our office. We've been giving out a lot of Canadian flags. They've been very popular these days. It is One thing that people can get at their MP's office is you can get a Canadian flag in a number of different sizes. That said, it's not the hill I'm going to die on, and I'll leave it to the town of Smithers to make those kinds of decisions.
I went downtown Smithers, just outside of MP Bacharach's office, to ask people what they thought about the American flag hanging there, and here's some of what passersby had to say. What do you think?
I think it sucks.
You want to see it taken down?
Yes, we do. I do.
Yeah. What's your main reason of wanting to, because they do rotate these flags, right?
Yeah.
Trump? What is it? Yeah. It represents Trump for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
They're not our friends anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They were.
Would you say October of 2024 you wouldn't have cared or noticed?
No.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't. I'd never noticed it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about the American flag hanging on Main Street?
It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
And in fact, you didn't even notice it.
I didn't notice it, no.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what do you think?
I don't really think, I think this will blow over between Canada and the United States. I think we should be together, you know, we're two countries that are side by side and help each other out with trade and everything else. So, yeah. So right now we can't do anything with the tariffs because we don't have a leader per se.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What do you think?
I don't have any problem with it. I think it's fine there.
Yeah.
So those are my words. Just, I didn't even notice it there, but since you brought it up, it looks fine there.
Yeah.
I'm Canadian, but I have no problem with.
It's funny. I think I'm bringing a lot more people's attention to it than most people had seen.
I know. I've never seen it there until you pointed it out to me. So no problem with it.
Yeah.
Just yeah.
Okay.
Awesome.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're standing actually underneath the American flag here on Main Street.
Okay.
What do you think about it being there?
I don't mind at all.
Yeah.
Everybody's okay here. Yeah. I like it. It's colorful and pretty. I don't know.
Are you from Smithers?
I'm actually from Ontario.
What are your thoughts on the flag there?
Why are there any of those flags on Main Street? Nationalism is one of the first steps toward fascism. So any display of nationalism is not cool with me.
The American one. People are saying that they want to take the American one down.
Yes. I would like to see it come down, too.
Yeah, you would?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure not all people in the United States agree with what's going on right now, you know. But as for Canada, I think that we should replace the flag, that flag, with maybe a Canadian flag. Or we should put the BC flag up there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
And thanks to CICK and Smithers for that report. Coming up next is our seasonal debut of Gardening with Embark. Stay tuned a little later for Peter's for a couple of reports about aluminum and the aluminum industry. Democracy Now! Comes up at 11 o'clock. But let's get going with Gardening with Embark. Well, good morning, Pablo.
Good morning.
Joining me is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. And we are here again with Gardening with Embark.
That's right.
Almost springtime, and that means it's time to really start thinking about the garden.
Correct. So in one more week, and we will have the spring switching from winter to spring. And yeah, it's time to be outdoors. And luckily today we have a nice sunny day.
Great. So we have a whole program of things we're going to be talking to you about this year. And we'll be here every week.
Correct.
On the radio and also online, where you can find this segment. And we'll be going right through this season from now until the first frost in November.
Yes, week 44. We are in week 11, so we have quite a bit to go.
Great. And as we go through the year, I mean, we're going to be talking about stuff that are relevant to gardeners in their gardens, whatever week we're in.
That's right.
And things you should be thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully you'll be tuning in every week to find out and learn about how you can make your gardening better.
That's right. So here we are. We are here to share some information, tips for you to become a better gardener over the years.
So for today's segment, our first of this season, you wanted to talk about the gardening cycle and how gardeners should be thinking about their gardens.
Yeah, so our garden cycle has six parts. We start with planning, which means this done during the winter, ordering the seed, deciding which plants I'm going to grow, where I'm going to get the soil. And then we move to soil preparation, like now. Now is the spring, and everybody is bringing fresh soil and nutrients to the garden. And then we move to seeding and planting. So we prepare our soil, lots of nutrients in there. We seed and plant. I noticed that there are some garden centers already with seedlings ready to come out.
Yep.
And then we go to move to the gardening care, which is most of the gardening section, which is caring, watering, weeding, making sure that there is no pests, controlling the slugs and all that, and moving that next when the plants are lovely, harvesting, how to harvest, and whatever is not edible goes back to the compost, which is the heart of the garden. A garden without composter is missing something, because whatever don't eat or gets old on a spent plant ends up in the composter, turns into soil, goes back to the garden soil, and the cycle closes. Yeah, so at the moment, I think most of the garden planting should have been happening.
Yeah.
If not, this is the time that you will decide to which vegetables you would like to plant. In the spring, we mainly focus on vegetables that gives us leaves and roots.
Yeah. What would those be?
So we have lettuce, spinach, arugula, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, and the roots will be carrots, radishes, turnips, beets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And for many gardeners, starting with seeds, they're going to have wanted to start their seeds already, right?
Yes. So when you start seeds, so we want to have our seedlings ready to go out for the first week of April.
Mm-hmm.
So usually a seed takes 7 days to germinate.
Yeah.
And it grows inside in the indoors for 6 to 8 weeks.
Right.
So 8 weeks from now, we are week 11 minus 8. We have to start in week 3 to 5. So right. Very early for the cabbage and broccolis.
Yeah.
So at the moment, I would just advise to go and buy it. for the cold crops.
Yeah, and the gardening stores have lots of seedlings now, which are
correct,
which have sprouted and are
ready to go out in the garden. Yeah. Outside, we can start directly like lettuces and mesclums, radishes, carrots. We can start from seed directly in the soil.
Yep.
Yeah. And that will, by starting seeds early in the season, we save time.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to spend this time waiting for the seeds to germinate and to grow. We just plant a seedling that is ready to continue growing, so we can have our first harvest by beginning of June, end of May.
Right.
Yeah.
When it comes to seeds, do you typically buy seeds? I mean, obviously part of the idea of farming and agriculture is that you can use the seeds from one season into the next. But at the same time, we're often trying to grow our crops so they don't go to seed.
That's right. So we hardly have our crops going to seed. For instance, lettuce, we don't let the lettuce go to seed, neither the cabbage or the broccoli.
Yeah.
So, here in Bark, we buy our seeds. We buy seeds raw, so they haven't been treated, that haven't been treated with pesticides or anything like that. As well, we don't like pellet seeds, because pellet seeds are seeds that are coated with clay or starch. We don't. We just buy raw seeds. Yeah.
And is that a philosophical thing?
Oh, no, because it's one is easier to use.
Yeah.
The other is a bit more seeds per package, because the coated seeds are less seeds.
Right. Better value.
Yes, for value, yeah.
Great. So one of the aspects of planning and the gardening cycle, and something we're going to talk about again and again and again throughout the year, is what week we're on. And maybe you can just talk about that and how meaningful that is. You know, whether, you know, I think we're in week 11, and each week we're using that to keep track of what we're doing.
Yeah, so we are in week 11. So at this moment is, if you are planning to start tomatoes, zucchinis, cucumbers, this is the time to start all these crops, and particularly tomatoes and peppers, and chili peppers. So you start with seeds indoors, and by week 20, when we have the May long weekend, they are ready to go out.
Right.
And by that time, we have a nice temperature outdoors, so like the plant we don't feel moving from indoors to outdoors. So that will be at the moment. And the other thing that we have at the moment is bringing nutrients to our soil. So we can have a different type of soil, like a soil amender, which is rich in compost and manure, rotten manure. Or if you start a new garden, you will go with a veggie mix. If you go with growing containers, you will try to find a nice potting soil. Yeah, so, and when we talk about how much nutrients our soil has, we had to consider two things. One is chemical nutrients, like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and micro elements, and as well the physical state. So if it's too heavy, we need to add either more compost, mushroom manure, to make it more fluffy. And as well, because soil is not only nutrients, but also is water and air that needs to be in the soil.
Right. So for the embarked gardens, you're typically working in raised gardens. And I know from last year that often you will churn a lot of the garden waste back into the soil to refresh it.
Yep.
For people working in pots, would you recommend that they refresh some of that soil or even all of that soil?
Yes. So potting soil needs to be refreshed. It's six months because it has some nutrients in there. And potting soil is very light. So it has some peat moss in there, has coconut coir, which they don't bring any nutrients. It's just make it fluffy and light. Because containers need to be light for us to be able to move.
Right.
So we hardly put any gardening soil in there. Otherwise, it gets too much heavy because lots of water.
Yeah.
So you don't need to throw away your potting soil. You just get fresh soil, mix it up, and refill your pots.
Great. So for next week, anything else you wanted to cover before we move on today?
So make sure before bringing soil, which is now at the moment that everybody is doing, bringing soil to your garden, think, I want more nutrients or I want to make my soil more fluffy, more airy. And if it's more airy, mushroom manure. If it's more nutrients, get veggie mix or soil amender, rich in compost. Yeah.
All right. And so, let's see, the gardening cycle, planning, soil preparation, seeding, we've talked about that. Garden care, that's all season.
Yes, the whole season, yeah.
Harvesting actually comes at a couple different times during the year, right?
Yes, harvesting is constantly. So with a small garden here in Embark, we harvest, we plant, we harvest, we plant, we harvest, we plant constantly. So the small space that we have always is producing some vegetables.
Right. And then composting, and we're back to the beginning. And that's what I talk about, churning your garden waste back into the soil to reuse that stuff.
Yes.
With all this stuff, and particularly the harvesting, you know, one of the things, you know, with the weeks we're talking about as we go through, really help you know when those are things need to be happening too, right? Because we're at the beginning, we're going to plant the seeds. It's going to be a while before
we can start harvesting.
But at some point, a few weeks along, we don't have to just wait until we watch what happens in the garden. We can anticipate this because we kind of know how the cycle works through the season based on what week we're in.
Correct. So we can anticipate knowing that that seed, how long the seed takes to germinate, and then how long the plant takes for the first harvest.
Yeah.
So usually between 5 to 6 weeks for lettuces. So after, week 8, we will start harvesting the leaves. So most of the leafy greens can be just harvested as a baby greens.
Yeah.
As the plant grow, we can continue harvesting the external leaves.
Great. So next week we're going to talk about garden planning and approach. Just very quickly, what is that going to mean for people?
So garden planning approach is, okay, so garden planning, what you're going to plant.
Yep.
And the approach, which kind of gardening are you doing? Are you going container gardening? Are you doing a square foot gardening? Right. Are you doing lasagna gardening? And there is 13 types of different approaches right. of gardening. So you decide, or you have your own method mm-hmm. of gardening, like growing in straw bales.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, that's next week. Thank you so much for coming in today, Pablo. Pablo Vimes of Embark Sustainability Society. How do people find out more about your programs?
So Embark Sustainability runs several programs during the year here at SFU. At the moment, in the coming week, we start the spring cohort. We have a space for 12 participants. We are full booked. So, and the next summer cohort will start on May the 9th. So we will, as we'll be promoting. So if you are interested in developing your skills, in how to garden, when to garden, how to plant, when to plant, join us for the summer cohort. All the cohort runs for 6 weeks, and we promote all these events through our social media channels, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, at Embark Sustainability.
Great. And, of course, if you join one of these cohorts, you're going to be in there getting your hands dirty, literally.
Literally, yes. So besides sharing what we're doing here, sharing some tips and hints, you will get your own raised garden bed to get hands-on and practice.
Yep. Great. Thank you for joining me today, Pablo Vimes of Embark Sustainability
Pleasure
Society.
To be here.
See you next week.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Aluminum is not just found in soda and beer cans. The material is used in all sorts of things, from cell phones and solar panels to electric vehicles and airplanes. And demand for many of these products is growing rapidly.
So not only is demand increasing here in the United States, but it's increasing around the world, which adds up to a whole lot more aluminum.
Annie Sartor is with Industrious Labs, an organization focused on reducing the climate impact of aluminum and other industrial materials. She says aluminum production requires a lot of electricity, and in places like China, where more than half of the world's aluminum is produced, much of that electricity comes from burning coal, so it creates a lot of global warming carbon pollution. But in places where more electricity comes from renewables, for example Canada, which uses a lot of hydropower, the climate impact is far less. Sartor says in many areas, renewable energy is becoming cost competitive.
Coal is not as cheap as it was comparatively around the world anymore.
So she says there's an opportunity for the industry to switch to using more clean energy and limit the harm aluminum production has on the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And your name is?
It's Kyla Knowles.
Kyla Knowles. You know what it was? I had done a show from a segment about aluminum because we got the aluminum tariffs. And hopefully, maybe when this is broadcast, it'll be rolled back, but I don't think it looks that way.
No.
And I didn't know you were a Port Moody counselor, but I have a lot of these Facebook people that I don't even know.
Yeah.
And I saw you were born in Kitimat.
Yes.
And I asked you a few questions on Facebook. And you were actually employed at the smelter. Now, okay, so you were born in Kitimat.
So I wasn't born, but I moved there with my parents when I was about two or three. So it's my hometown. It's where I grew up. It's where I graduated high school. My mother still lives there.
Did you do any traveling out of Kitimat prior to coming to SFU and so on?
I went on vacations with my family. You know, we would come down to Vancouver or visit my grandmother in Saskatchewan. I remember my parents took us to the Olympics in Los Angeles in
Los
84.
Angeles.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's it would be more exciting if you just we're always there, and you didn't, and you came to the big town.
it was still a big town. It was still really a big change for me when I came down here in 94.
8,000 people is the population now.
Is it really? Wow. So when I was growing up, it was about 11,000 or so, and it was booming, and it was kind of a healthy town, but there's no question that it has declined in recent years.
It's declined.
Yeah, with the loss of Yurikan some years ago, and Ocelot, which I believe is now Methanex.
Well, what exactly are these entities?
So Yurikan was a pulp and paper plant that employed a lot of people during my childhood. And I believe that shut down, maybe 10 or 15 years ago now. And that was a big loss to the town. And what was known as Ocelot, now Methanex, also employed less than 100 people. But that was also a loss. So that left us with Alcan as the big last remaining industry.
It was at one time not just a one in industry town then.
Correct.
And so that, I can't get in the population. I had seen it. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page now, mm-hmm. when it was more obvious. Yeah. But what I find interesting is that you were employed at the smelter, and you were one of 50. The other were men, and you were the only woman.
So every summer, and I still have to give big kudos to Rio Tinto Alcan for this. They would hire about 50 summer students every summer, and it was by a lottery system because so many of us were trying to get in. So one summer, I remember I was picked number 52, and so I didn't get a job. But as people had to do fitness tests, spaces became available. So two people before me failed the fitness test. So I managed to get one of the very last positions available that summer, and that was working in the pot lines in Kitimat. And the lines that I worked in were 1 through 8, and yes, I was the only woman on my entire shift of hundreds of men.
Have there been women since and before then?
I believe so. I'm sure there were other summer students besides me. It's not, it was very heavy, heavy labor. I would lose about 15 to 20 pounds every summer. And I know today, my understanding is that it's less labor intensive. But I have heard that there are several women working in the pot lines now.
Is that from automation as such?
I think so. So I had a conversation with a friend of mine on the way up here, and he is currently employed there. And my understanding is that they've got a newer technology that requires less babysitting of the pots, if you will. And so back when I worked there, when a pot would get sick, which would mean there was too much carbon buildup, and you had to kind of remove that carbon. That doesn't happen as much now because the technology is different. Instead of one big large carbon block on the top, it's multiple carbon blocks, so they can isolate what's making the pot sick and almost extract it like a cancer.
Well, it's bauxite. Is that
something? Yeah, bauxite or alumina is the base.
My understanding is that when you smelter it, it goes from bauxite to alumina.
Correct, yeah.
And then it becomes aluminum.
Correct. Yep, that's right.
The other thing is that it's a compound bauxite. It's aluminum happens to be a pure. It is mm-hmm. a pure element on the periodic table.
Yeah. So what happens is the bauxite or alumina goes into the pot, and then we use electricity that goes through the carbon. That essentially it's just electrolysis. It separates the molecules from each other, and the aluminum sinks to the bottom of the pot, and then it's extracted.
Were there any problems being the only woman working there?
Oh, that might be a subject of another of another story. But yeah, let's just say I got a lot of attention.
But you did it for 2 summers.
For 2 summers. So as a summer student, you're entitled to go back for four summers. Yeah. Once you're in, you kind of were in, which is the great thing. I chose not to go back in my third year because, not what you think, but because I was doing the co-op program here, actually, at SFU. And I wanted to work in my field so that I would have a better chance of getting a job when I got out. My mother was very upset. She wanted me to stay at Alcan because the money was so good for a summer student, but I thought it was important to start getting experience in my field.
One of the things that when I was messaging you on Facebook about this, I was a bit interested because there's a lot of talk you need to be apprenticed to be an electrician to do What does the woman do in Flashdance?
Oh,
she does that sort of the fireworks stuff.
Oh, yeah, okay.
A blowtorch or something.
It's welding.
Well, she's a welder. And usually you have to be an apprentice for things like that. I was a bit surprised that really there wasn't any need for that for this employment.
No, I would not say that this is something that you had to be skilled to do. I mean, look at, they took me off the street. I was a 19-year-old kid, and they gave me 2 days of training in a room. They checked that my fitness was good. They suited me up, and they sent me in there. There's not a lot of thinking required, to be quite honest with you. And there's, I mean, whether or not it was dangerous, I mean, accidents definitely happened. It's definitely risky. And they had a union. They still do.
What's the union?
Oh, back when I was there, it was CAW, Canadian Auto Workers.
Canadian Auto Workers.
I can't say for sure what it is today, but the union was very active.
Well, the union in the United States for all the big three, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, is one union. I forget the specific name of that.
Yeah.
But I guess it's the same in Canada for the big three. And
I don't know.
And then they sort of go into other things like aluminum smelting and so on, which is not a bad idea.
I have heard through the grapevine that there is a risk. There's going to be a strike vote this summer, and I do know that they're pretty concerned about that up north right now.
But maybe they picked the wrong time, unfortunately, for that.
Yeah.
Oh, so they want more for what they're doing.
Well, I mean, such as it is for unions, right? They're constantly advocating on behalf of their membership, and whether it's safety, benefits, pay.
Well, okay, the current situation, you talked to someone still employed there?
Yes.
What's the word in Kitimat about all what's going on?
I mean, I only spoke really to him about it, but he's hoping that doesn't happen because it'll be tough for the town. It always is.
But it already has happened, unfortunately.
What has happened?
The tariffs, 25...
So, to be honest with you, I did ask him about kind of the tariffs, what the effect of that would be. And because he's involved on the production side, he's not that involved in the marketing and sales side. So he doesn't know if there's any worry about that. But he does know that Kitimat is an extraordinarily efficient plant itself, or smelter, I should say, because we have Kamano providing the electricity, and that's a major part.
Which I was at.
You've been there.
I'm 62 years old. I was there in 1966.
Oh, wow.
As part of some open house. So I was actually there.
Well, you're very lucky. Very few people have been there.
Was it not built by 66? I was sort of wondering.
It would have been in the process of being built, but the thing is, it's not in Kitimat, right?
Oh,
it's,
that's why we were able to have some sort of open house of it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so Kamano is 45 miles southeast of Kitimat.
Yeah, and that's where we get the majority of electricity.
When you get all of it, because I heard that actually 15% goes back to the BC Hydro grid.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. And I remember hearing when I was younger, it was a rumor, and I don't know if this is true, but that in fact we were able to sell surplus energy that from Kamano to the government and then on to California.
Oh, from the Kamano.
Back then, yes.
And any last words on your aluminum experience?
No, not really. I mean, I still am very fond of my experience there. I learned really hard work. I learned to appreciate unions when I worked there. I still go up all the time, and you know, aluminum is really the lifeblood of that town. I mean, the motel is called, you know, the Aluminum City Motel. Everything revolves around aluminum. To this day, I was telling you, I will only buy Alcan branded tinfoil. So it's an important industry, certainly for Kitimat, but other cities as well.
Well, we may have some updates with the tariff situation. Hope it goes down. Mm-hmm. With the other people, you know, you maybe be able to phone them and have a recorded message like this.
Yeah, I can definitely ask around and see if there's somebody involved on the sales side.
And we'll just keep on. Well, it's also the employment all across the board would be affected, wouldn't it?
I did ask that, and he said he's heard nothing about that so far. So far, so good. He doesn't seem to think it's going to change their operations or the amount that they produce, but they may start looking for new customers.
Okay. All right. I'm going to give you another last word. Just say anything else you want to say?
Nothing from me other than thanks for having me. And I'm thinking of my friends and family in Kitimat as we get through this constant up and down with these tariffs.
Okay. Over and out for now.